Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on this weekend edition of Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com. Coming up on this edition, depression is the leading cause of ill health and disability worldwide, according to some new reports. Probably not that surprising, but a very interesting report to look at. We got some interesting history today on the M1A2 Abrams tank and the state of the U.S. military. Also preview of the Trumpet Daily Radio Show and brand new Key of David this weekend. That and more in this weekend edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. And online, we are at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com there. You can listen on the TuneIn app, various other places as well. I'm Dwight Falk, Abraham Blondeau here today. And a lot of great programming to discuss on the station this weekend. A lot of things to listen to. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury, went into talking about the new Churchill movie that's coming out. Maybe you've heard about that or seen some previews, some write-ups. They played the, I guess it's the trailer for it. It sounds pretty epic, as most movie trailers do. But the thing that's so interesting about it, it is a perverse telling of the history. It's not the actual history.
Right. Yeah, just like we talked about yesterday, and I think it's really disturbing that that's the trend. And I think another point, one article I read earlier this week said is that there's a new assault on Churchill himself. There's a new wave of revisionism. A lot of them are from authors of former British colonies who do attack him as an imperialist and as that's an evil thing. And so that's a new trend out there, is that attacking Churchill's stature as a giant of history and as the greatest Briton ever. So it is interesting to see that as Britain declines in power and prestige around the world, they also seem to attack the great figures of their past more and more, which to me, it seems if you want to regain power, you need to look at what they did right.
Yeah. Yeah. Whenever they tear down the person, and Winston Churchill was a messenger in a lot of ways. He warned Britain. When you tear down the messenger, then you tear down the message too. And so it's a very captivating trailer that they played. I was listening to it this morning and stopped in us. You know, they did a good job putting the trailer together. It sounds interesting, but we had talked about it the other day, and you had some really good information about that. And so as I was listening to it, I was thinking about what you had said, because I hadn't heard the trailer previously or seen it. And some of the lines that I assumed that the man playing Winston Churchill was saying, I thought, oh, yeah, we talked about, like, how, you know, he had never said those things. He never acted that way, but boy, they sure put together quite a dramatic presentation.
Yeah, they. I think Churchill's a really appealing figure for an actor to play and to depict, because he does have the dramaticism, and his lines are very rich English written. So, but the thing with that movie, though, is I'm pretty sure almost every single line in that movie he never said. Like, there's no historical context for it at all. Even the speeches he supposedly gave, either they took place years before 1944, or they're just completely made up. And now, most movies, I mean, you have to have a little bit of artistic license, so, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, because you have to compress events and you can't do everything exactly like it was done in real life. But to put your own words in his mouth when it's proven that that wasn't who he was historically and factually, I think that's basically this Churchill, the one played by Brian Cox in the new Churchill movie, he basically becomes a mouthpiece of anti-British, anti-American propaganda, when that's not who he was at all. That's actually a gross misrepresentation of this man.
It'd be interesting to see how much money it makes in Britain and in the U.S. versus other nations. They always release the movies, most movies, and around the world, and And I would think other nations would maybe like that more. You know, but that just is the state of our world today here in the West, I guess, where some people really do subscribe to that line of thinking that, you know, in the past was a big mistake and we did things the wrong way. But yet, the Nazis were defeated. How is that a bad thing? Right? But somehow they try to make it like, well, the West was still a bad place and it didn't do good things in the global sense.
Yeah, exactly. I think a great example of that is in India, a particular author, she's a historian. She just printed a new book and she's made some speeches about it where she condemns Churchill quite violently for the Bengal famine of 1943. In India, there was a huge famine. I think 2 million people died just from the climate and everything collapsed in India during World War II. And she criticizes Churchill for, instead of sending grain and rice to India, he sent them to Europe and other places. And a lot of Indian people resent Churchill for that, even though a lot of people point out they were in the midst of World War II. They were still on the retreat in the Far East, in the Pacific War against Japan. India at that time was under threat of Japanese invasion. There's just a small British army in Burma standing between them and the Japanese. And when you read the Rape of Nanking and the terrible things the Japanese did, to me, the big thing from those accusations, Churchill's not spotless. He made mistakes, and he maybe could have handled that situation better. But Britain did spare India from Japanese occupation. And when you read of what happened to the Chinese people, I think there's a certain amount of gratefulness that should be there that they didn't have to experience the scourge of the Japanese Empire.
Right. Yeah. Even there are plenty of examples from World War II where the Germans, one of the reasons they fought the Russians so fiercely was they were hoping to buy enough time to be captured by the West.
Right.
Because you wanted to be captured by the West because they would treat you with some dignity and respect and do some of those horrible, horrible things, and you know, across the board anyway, that would happen if those Asian powers captured them. And so that it's so interesting you read that, and the West is still made out to be some sort of a villain, but even the hardened soldiers knew we'd better fight so we can be captured by the West instead of falling into the hands of the Russians.
Yeah, exactly. There's just tales of the brutality of Russians, Germans, and Japanese, what they would do to prisoners of war. I'm not obviously getting into details, but they're just horrific and things we never thought we'd see in the 20th century. And for example, in the Far East, when Singapore surrendered, there were about over 100,000 British, Indian, and other soldiers there who surrendered to the Japanese. The Japanese view surrender as the most dishonorable action imaginable. So they viewed those people as less than human. They were put on death marches. They were also used as slave labor. For example, we all know of the bridge on the River Kwai from the movie and the book. The actual man who built that and to build the Burma Railroad, they had to dig a tunnel or a shaft through a mountainside in 12 weeks, but with hand, just using pickaxes and stuff.
Wow.
And they did it. And they were, when you read the tales of what they went through, like basically working till exhaustion, Japanese moving the body of the way, throwing someone else there to get through the rock with a pickaxes on time. Just the labor conditions are things we would never imagine. And so that's just besides all the mutilations and murders and everything else they did to the soldiers. Just that is probably a lot of those young British men who signed up to fight the Japanese never imagined that would be the consequences of defeat.
Yeah, so it's much different history when you read about it, World War II, Winston Churchill, than when you see a movie like this. So as was pointed out on the Trumpet Daily Radio show today, you better spend your time reading a book about it, a good book, some good history of what actually happened instead of plopping down whatever it costs to see a movie these days. It seems like it's about $20.
Yeah.
It's probably not that much, but they always try to push you into the 3D theater. I don't think this one would be in 3D. There'd probably be no point, but who knows? They get you every which way. spend the money on the book, get the book instead, a good book, and read it and learn the real history instead of watching these movies.
Well, you can get books like abebooks.com. You can get some books for 50 cents, less than a dollar, sent to your house, and really great history books.
Is that your company?
I wish. So that was my idea, and I looked online. I'm like, oh, they already have it.
And they took my name, too.
Yeah. So, books are less expensive because when you buy a movie ticket, you see the movie in 3 hours, and that's it. A book, you can have it for your whole life and keep rereading it and learning new things from it.
Yeah, so better use of the time there. TheTrumpet.com today, some of the headlines you might want to check out, feature story is Christian schools told to allow homosexual clubs or close. That comes up in the news from time to time and is, it's a hot topic. They say the homosexual lobby continues to try to force its way into all schools everywhere. That's the main write-up at TheTrumpet.com. Related to that, Nationalizing the Family, that's by Andrew Miller. And Redefining Family by Joel Hilliker. And that one is a book as well, a book that you can get. And it's free at thetrumpet.com. And it's a really pretty thought-provoking read and great information. And already I think they need to update it just because things have changed so much even within the family structure in the U.S. and the West since it was written a few years ago.
Yeah. Well, I think the biggest development was the landmark case in the Supreme Court granting same-sex marriage across the United States. So that fundamentally will always shape, will alter the family because now it changes and it challenges the Christian understanding of marriage that was the foundation of American society from the founding fathers. So that will always fundamentally challenge that belief as long as it exists. But as we've seen, there's always headlines every day just a lot of tension between religious groups and social progressive groups. And there's both those groups, I don't think there's any compromise. There's always going to be tension and conflict there. And while they're both fighting for ideals, it's the kids and the families of everyday Americans that suffer the most because they're the ones who have to deal with the lashback and just the different policies they come up with.
Yeah, really some interesting write-ups there at thetrumpet.com. Also, a brand new Key of David this weekend, The Mystery of Civilization, that continues the series from Mystery of the Ages. Human civilization is more advanced today than at any time in history, yet man's problems are multiplying at an alarming rate. What is the cause of this paradox? Make sure you listen for that program here on KPCG. You can watch it on thetrumpet.com or on YouTube. And various other locations. And, of course, it's on television across the U.S. and Canada and really around the world in a lot of places this weekend. Check your local listings at thetrumpet.com. This is kind of an interesting write-up here from AOL. We talked the other day about that boy in Europe. We found that old Nazi jet buried in his backyard.
Right.
Which was amazing to find something. And the pilot was in there, too. Worse for wear.
Yeah.
He was not... He was not alive anymore, but really amazing find. They say there are heaps of World War II junk rusting in Greenland, and the photos are eerily beautiful. So the U.S. has left some of those old things they were using in the war, and they're just sitting out there in Greenland. So it's pretty interesting. It's at AOL. There's some pretty cool photos that you can check out, about 20 photos. And that happens. Big projects, whether they're construction or war or something, and sometimes they're abandoned, and then they just sit there out in the wilderness.
Yeah, it's neat because usually they're untouched besides the wear and tear of nature. But it's almost like you can step back in time because you can't really understand something without seeing it and feeling it, something from the past. So when you can do that, it just really transports you back there and you get an idea of what it was like. And I think a lot of people are interested in like World War II stuff, like seeing the old jeeps, the tanks, the planes. So that would just be really neat to basically walk among a graveyard of all those things.
Yeah, especially in Greenland because it's such a sort of a stark landscape, mountains and water and really beautiful, but not a lot out there. They have one picture where there's a hill that you can go up and look down. There's probably at least 100 feet or so down. You'll see this huge line of barrels. that doesn't quite fit in. It's just a huge amount that were dumped there. There's military vehicles, like you mentioned, and they're just rusting. It's interesting because if you stumbled upon it and you didn't know, I guess you'd have to be pretty sheltered. But if you didn't know the history of why they would be there, it would be quite a conundrum. What's this stuff doing here? Who put this here? So it's really interesting to look at those photos, old Jeeps, like you said, just different materials that they were working with and using. And unfortunately, it's like a rusted junkyard. It doesn't look great.
Right. Yeah, it's a shame those things go to a museum somewhere because those would have been really neat to preserve. I know one thing I think most men dream of is owning a Willys Jeep at some point in their life because they're pretty much indestructible and you can use them for anything.
They go like 35 miles an hour.
Yeah.
They're not fast.
Perfect for a school zone.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you know, you can actually buy those and they still have the guns on them.
Right.
And you don't want that one. That would make people a little bit nervous, I think. Probably not legal to drive around with that.
Yeah.
But you can find those. They're on eBay. A lot of people, you know, it's a sort of a niche collecting thing that people get into. But this stuff up in Greenland, they say, was abandoned by the U.S. Air Force in 1947. And it's Blue East 2 is one of several World War II and Cold War installations that they had there left to crumble in Greenland after the military lost interest in maintaining them. And so they're just sitting up there now. Blue was military code for Greenland, which is interesting. They didn't use green, I guess. Maybe that would have been too obvious. Bluey East, Bluey East was two was one of the three aircraft bases maintained on the Danish territory in North America as part of the U.S. Atlantic defense scheme of the period. So they pulled out. They didn't bother to take the stuff. They just got out of there.
Yeah. Well, I'm surprised no one took it for scrap or made money off it or something. I guess. I mean, it's still U.S. property, so I imagine no one can take it. But they just let it to rot. So kind of a wasteful thing. But in the 1947, America looked like it would never run out of steel and all those things. Probably.
Well, there's no matter what it is, whether it's military or just here in Oklahoma, you have the old oil wells, and I don't hear as many announcements about that. But there used to be public service announcements about cleaning those up and staying away from them, and you know, because kids might get in there and have some problems. And yeah, there's all kinds of things where you just see stuff from the past that got abandoned and left, and somebody's got to clean it up. Usually the property owner, I guess, if you buy the property. But kind of interesting there. It's at AOL. You can take a look at that. Heaps of World War II junk rusting in Greenland. And the photos are eerily beautiful. I don't know. I don't know if they were eerily beautiful, but that's what they said. You know, there's actually, and I'm pretty sure this actually happened. I always debate whether this was a dream or this actually happened, but I'm sure it happened. If you drive out west here in Oklahoma, if you're heading out west, there's a junkyard. I'm sure I drove by it. It was a junkyard, but what was so strange about it was there was aircraft there, like commercial aircraft lined up.
Huh.
And I assume they were just junk. And it was kind of out in the middle of nowhere. And when I think about that, I'm like, that did happen, right? Like, I did see that because it was so odd. But I think that's what it was. It was like a junkyard for aircraft. Really strange to see.
Yeah, they do usually in the, like Arizona, those types of places where there's just big open spaces. They do have places where they retire aircraft, quote unquote, which just means they just sit in the hangar and rot because there's no use for them until they can be sold for scrap or something, I guess. But that might have been one of those places. But it's just odd where you can drive right past them, like, and they're not under lock and key or anything like that.
What I thought was, boy, if I was a little kid, I'm sure it'd be dangerous, but how fun it would be to play in like a commercial airliner that's just abandoned out on the field. Strange stuff. You got an interesting write-up here, Abraham, from the independent.co.uk. This is a study that's been conducted about depression. It says, depression is a leading cause of ill health and disability worldwide, according to the World Health Organization. The title says, who finds? I had to read it twice. I'm like, who? Oh, World Health Organization. Yeah. Maybe that's what Doctor Who was. Somebody asked me that. My son asked me that. He said, who is Doctor Who? I said, I don't know. He's some sort of character, you know. But maybe he was part of the World Health Organization.
Yeah, or maybe he was the lead singer of The Who.
It could be. There's another story related to this as well. There's another headline says, feeling lonely might worsen your cold, study finds. So they're finding that, like this other article points out, your mood, your attitude, it has a lot to do with not only your mental health, but your physical health.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting article because it does point out to a crisis that isn't really talked about that much, and that's, I think, the crisis of people's mental health, their frame of mind. And according to the World Health Organization, depression is now the leading cause of ill health disability across the whole world. And it follows a huge spike in the number of people who report living with the condition. So just in the last few years, more people have admitted to having depression. And so depression has overtaken lower respiratory disease as the biggest global health problem. So before, it was respiratory disease that was the major cause. And it says more than 300 million people worldwide are diagnosed with depression. And that's an increase of 18% over the last 10 years. So 300 million people, that's almost the whole population of America
that
think they have depression. I think it's interesting because depression, it's a mental, it's a frame of mind. And there are some physical biochemistry reasons for it. But I think what it represents is we're seeing how modern society, modern entertainment, modern lifestyles are starting to impact people's mental stability. And I think that's the most interesting part of it, is that we're seeing so many people with depression. And I think it's linked with violent movies, violent video games. We're seeing a lot more broken homes, kids growing up without two parents, unemployment, all these different issues, I think, are culminating in the people having depression, which then degenerates their physical health.
There have been stories this week about how there's a major heroin epidemic in the white middle class or working class. I'm not sure how they would define it. But because of depression, in a lot of cases, unemployment, like you mentioned, life's just not going well, and they become depressed, and then they're looking for an outlet, and of course make it much, much worse. And in thinking about depression, I thought, you know, one of the big things I think is the, like, say, unemployment. Just not being busy, whether you're affluent or not, just having too much time on your hands and nothing to do, I think that leads to a lot of, I think it does lead to depression. When you're busy and you're active, you almost don't have time to be depressed in a lot of ways.
Yeah, well, I think, too, a lot of people assign their self-worth to accomplishment. And if you're looking for a job, you can't find one. I think people get depressed because it's like no one wants, doesn't think you're needed, doesn't think you're valuable, so they won't even hire you. And I think for a lot of men, especially maybe who worked for a long time and now don't have jobs, it's easy to get depressed over the outlook of your life because now you can't make an income. You have to rely on the government or other incomes in your household to survive. And I think that's a big blow to any kind of self-esteem, the things that make us feel good or accomplished. And so I think part of it is definitely that it's hard to not be depressed when life is going in the exact opposite direction of what you intend. And also it seems like there's no goal in your life. And I think, like talking about Churchill, he had something called melancholia, which is like he called his black dog, which is a form of depression. And usually he got depressed when he thought he was rudderless or he wasn't seeking a job or his prospects politically were very low. That's usually when he became depressed. And I think that's the same with a lot of people.
Yeah, for sure. I've read that Abraham Lincoln suffered with a little bit of that too, but they obviously didn't let it hold them back. They kept moving forward. But, you know, it's like it probably equates somewhat to just your overall, like if you look at just your physical health, if you stop moving and you're not active, it's harder to move, right? Your body starts to kind of break down because you're not using it. And, but in the same way is if you're not busy and you're not active and you're not doing things physically and mentally, it seems like the whole being just sort of degenerates. I mean, we're designed to live, right? To do something. And if you don't do anything, then it is kind of, and again, sometimes it's because maybe the person, you know, doesn't have work or something. It may not be their particular fault, but in a lot of cases, it's just affluence too. Teenagers, they don't have to do anything in some cases because they have what they need. And so you fill your time with, you know, distractions and so forth. But I do think at the end of the day, that's a pretty depressing lifestyle.
Yeah. Well, I think if we look at the amount of teenage depression, suicides, violence with young people, school shootings, a lot of that does spawn from unhappy home situations, but also from the consumption of recreational entertainment like video games, movies. And I think as a young person, those seem really, that seems like the life you want to live. Just sit at home, eat junk food, and watch and consume all that as much as you want. But I think what they're finding is there's no feeling of accomplishment. There is no benefit to that. And it just makes you feel empty. And especially when maybe you have trouble socially with people, it can just lead to a lot of irrational behavior, violent behavior, because you're not filling your mind with productive things that you would do if you had different hobbies, or if you had a job, or you were doing something where you had to work for something, where you had to attain something.
Yeah, the you know how it is. If you're home from work for a day or school or something, and you're not sick, I don't know, maybe you have vacation. First day is kind of nice, and you know, second maybe is okay, but eventually you get a little bored, especially if you don't have some other activity to do and to be involved in, and you just start to feel not well. You want to get up and go do something, and that's why solitary confinement's sort of torturous. It's a penalty,
right?
When you just have to sit and do nothing in a box. I mean, nobody wants that. That's like the worst thing possible, because we want to be active in doing things. And if we don't, then we kind of put ourselves in a little bit of a solitary confinement almost.
Yeah, well, exactly. I think if you look at the human mind, what it can do, like we can create things, have imagination. Then the human body, we have fingers, we have thumbs. We can hold tools.
Most of us, yes.
Yes. We can do things. We can, like the human body is designed to move.
Yeah.
The human mind is designed to consume knowledge and create new things. And when you deprive a person from that, I think it does result in depression, because you're not doing what you were created to do. I think that just leads to a natural conflict within yourself of, well, what's the point? And you start, you just start getting depressed over your outlook and the whole point of you being there. And I think once you start questioning that, that's usually where it all begins.
And so this report that you've got here from the World Health Organization, what they're finding is then when you get to that state of depression, then you get ill physically as well.
Yeah, exactly. That they're finding that people who are depressed or who are diagnosed with it, it's followed by other health issues. So it's not just they're sad and they experience melancholy. It's they actually have physical health problems too. Where maybe their bones start aching, they start getting more susceptible to disease and that sort of thing. And so it has pretty serious repercussions on you, just even physically. And this article goes through a lot on talking about creating jobs with money, funding healthcare, funding social groups that can help people with depression. All those things I think would go a long way in helping people. But I think it all comes back to the individual and avoiding that from happening. And as Herbert Armstrong said, he wrote a lot about health. Almost the most important thing is to have a positive mental attitude, because I think even for me, if I'm starting to get sick, if I don't think I'm sick, if I stay positive, I can get over it quickly. If I concede that I'm sick, or if I concede or get depressed, usually the sickness comes quickly, and then I'm actually have to stay home and confine myself to quarantine.
Yeah, I saw a really interesting report the other night. I think it was on PBS NewsHour, and they were talking about soldiers with post-traumatic stress disorder and how, you know, obviously it is sort of a form, I guess, of depression, obviously caused by something very specific. But the thing they were pointing out was that people are embarrassed by it, a lot of them, particularly because they're soldiers and they're trained to, you know, be tough and not admit something like that. And so they were talking about how people are trying to cope with it, but at the same time trying to get people to admit it and try to get some help best they can. And that's probably the same sort of thing with depression. And so it's an odd sort of, it's hard to go up to somebody and be like, well, I'm depressed. You know, well, what does that mean? You know, you just don't feel good today. You're sad about something. It can be a bigger issue. And there's a stigma to it. And it's somewhat embarrassing. So I think a lot of times people don't maybe go and really get the help that they need, whatever that might be. And it probably would vary for each person, and just try to bottle it up. And a lot of times that doesn't work very well.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I remember Romeo Dallaire, he's one of the biggest advocates about post-traumatic stress. And he would go with his father, who is a World War II veteran, to the Canadian Legion. And they all sit around, drink beer, and talk about things. And they would cry. And they would have all these emotions they couldn't control from remembering friends who died and all that. And then you'd have the young cadets, the young bucks in the Army, who would look at them and look down on them with disdain, saying, oh, I'll never be like that. I'm tough. I'm a man. I'm not going to cry like those weaklings. When 10 years later, when they've been through war and combat, they're doing the same thing. And so there's that stigma where depression or post-traumatic stress is seen as shameful or weak, like a sign of weakness. And so I think people who have depression, they're not willing to admit it to others because they're afraid to be seen as weak or having bigger issues. Or even they're not willing to face the main problem within themselves too. Like they have to change something to get over it. I think that's another issue as well.
Yeah, because it's very easy to, I mean, the soldiers would be a different situation because of what they experienced. But just for other people, I think it's easy to say, well, I feel a certain way, in this case, depressed, and it's because of an external situation, or it's because of somebody else. And that might be part of it, but a lot of times it is sort of a personal thing that, you know, maybe you do need to make some changes. That's hard to do. It's always easier to blame something else than to admit, like, well, maybe I need to change some things. So that's a hard part of it too. Nobody likes to change.
Yeah. Well, and I've been reading a book about Winston Churchill. It's called Warlord. And it's a great book. And going through his early life, what I never really thought of before is that of all children in Great Britain, he was probably the one that should have been the most depressed. Mm-hmm. His parents were having constant affairs. And in the course of a year, he maybe saw them three or four times during a whole year when he was at boarding school. They barely wrote back to him. When they did write back to him, his father would say he was a failure. He would never amount to anything. Things that would probably destroy a child of any lesser spirit than Winston Churchill. And so I think a lot of his depression does stem back from unhappy family situation. I mean, his situation growing up with that family, his father died when he was 19 or 20, leaving debts that he had to pay off. And, well, his whole inheritance that he should have gotten went to paying his father's debts. So he didn't even get an inheritance. So there's a lot of things he could have been bitter about or depressed him as a young person. And I think he overcompensated with his vanity and with self-elation, those sort of things. That's how he coped with it. But at the same time, he was very positive. He was an optimist. And by the time he was 25, he had written 5 books, fought in 4 wars on 3 different continents, and he didn't let those things hold him back. And to me, that's just a great example for, well, I was applying to myself, any young person who experienced depression and other things, that he's a great example on how to overcome those things. And that you can, despite your depression or anything, you can still achieve great things if you put your mind to it.
Yeah, you got busy.
Yeah.
And you don't really have time to think about, because really I think a lot of it probably stems from thinking about yourself and your situation. And there are various, there are obviously some different situations there. It's not to paint it all with one brush, but in some cases it might be that. And so the busier you are, the less time you have to really think about it.
Yeah.
That's a write-up from the independent.co.uk. Depression, the leading cause of ill health and disability worldwide. It's amazing. According to the WHO. Not the WHO, the World Health Organization. You've got a history story for us. Before we get into that, this kind of ties into being depressed or being happy. This is a little write-up here. It says, don't quit. How to be happy at a job that you just don't like. Sometimes you're in those situations, and it's better to not always quit. They say there's some things you can do even if you're in a situation you don't love. The first thing they say you can do is learn as much as you can. Just because you don't like the job doesn't mean you can't use it as an opportunity to learn. You know, I had jobs, I think we all have, growing up that they weren't ideal. It wouldn't be your preference if you could pick a dream job, but you need to make some money and you're young. But, you know, I learned something in every one of those jobs, even if it was just, well, I don't want to do this job. You know what I mean? It's a prod to go out and do other things. And I was thinking too about the whole depression situation. I had a job that I really didn't like when I was in college. But I'll tell you, every day there was one moment of absolute a thrill that I probably have rarely experienced. And it was being done with the job, driving home. It was a physical job, so I was physically like tired, and I was done. Yeah. And it was the greatest feeling in the world. I want to bottle that feeling because it was really nice.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's always the phrase "do hard things," because even if you don't like them in the moment, in hindsight, there's a lot of benefits. Or even when you're done, you realize the benefits of it. And before coming to college, all the jobs I had, I didn't really like at all. But you need money, and you need to save up for college and other things. But at each job, I did learn a lot of really valuable skills. And really, when I did find a job I liked at college and after college, what I'm doing now, it's all those jobs I didn't like is that gave me some principles I could use in the job I did like, so I could be successful at it. And it just made me more grateful for having bosses that treat you with respect in that and are considerate, because sometimes you run to a boss that they don't really care about you. You're just there to punch the clock and do your job. And so I think having those kinds of jobs help us become better employees when we do find the job we like.
Yeah, for sure. And if you can develop the character or have the character to show up every day on time for a job you do not like, that goes a long way. It says a lot about, you know, you as a person, and it's that in and of itself is one of the most valuable, I think, skills out there. Just show up, man.
Yeah.
You know, I've had some jobs where I couldn't leave until the next guy came, because we were, you know, it was kind of a you had to be there. And I always knew I'd look at the schedule and say, oh, I got to plan for at least another 30 minutes, because who knows when this guy's going to show up. And that was an irritant for sure. So, you don't want to be that guy.
Right. Yeah. Because I remember one job I had, I got into a habit of being late, and it wasn't a good habit, but I wasn't an important guy. And almost everyone at that job was late, because we're all like young people in high school. And no one really looked checked in on us. But my parents got after me, and other people got after me. So I worked really hard to fix it. It was hard to get out of that rut, because it's so easy. And I had to walk 30 minutes. So if I didn't leave on time, it wasn't like it was a 5-minute drive, and I had to leave 30 minutes before to make sure I got there on time. Yeah. And eventually I got really consistent. And I mean, sometimes you always battle with that, but it's always one thing I learned is don't get into the habit, because it's hard to break out of it once you do get into it.
Yeah, and if you can't be there on time, it's very hard to be consistently late. You know what I mean? Like, you can't say, well, I'll always be 2 minutes late. Well, that 2 becomes 3, becomes 5, becomes 10, becomes, it just,
yeah.
At some point, you got to draw the line. One other thing they say in this write-up, don't quit, how to be happy at a job that maybe isn't your favorite, is to make a plan. Instead of wasting time and energy worrying about how miserable you are, they say, take some action, save some money, and figure out what you want to do and move on to something else. So I think that's some good advice. Too often, I think I've seen people quit too early when they could have learned something, or, you know, it doesn't look good on your resume either if you work somewhere for a day and a half.
Right.
Unless it was a temp job. You want to have been there for a little while at least.
Yeah, it's it always good test of character for those, but also helps you build contacts and reputation, and those are really important, because I know sometimes people don't get a job even though they're really qualified because of their reputation with other, like they'll call your contacts and past employers, and eventually that's what holds you up from advancement or getting a better job.
Yeah, so there's some good points there. You've got a history write up for us here, Abraham. This is an article that you were working on for the trumpet.com. And it's about the M1A2 Abrams tank. And I guess people would think, well, that's an interesting thing to discuss. But it shows something about the U.S. military in general.
Yeah. So the article is based on some comments by a General Murray. He testified before the Senate's Armed Services Committee, Armed Intelligence Committee, and just about how U.S. armor, U.S. tanks are becoming obsolete, that we're falling behind the competition of our rivals. And since 1990, America's main battle tank has been the M1A2 Abrams. And I think that's the tank everyone's seen pictures of. It was in Operation Desert Storm, the war in Iraq, and different places. And so the danger of this is that it does threaten that in future conflicts, the U.S. military will be fighting at a disadvantage. They haven't since World War II. And but it also shows that in general, the U.S. military, they're conceding technological superiority to Russia in particular. And that's, I think, a big problem when we're seeing how belligerent Russia is becoming on the world stage.
Yeah, it's interesting because the I'm sure we do have some war exercises, military exercises, but the ones that always get reported, or that I see anyway, are the Russian-Chinese ones. And they're pretty impressive. They put on a pretty good show with their military and their marching through different areas and flying their planes and stuff. And so even in there, it seems like once a year at least they love to put on their big parade and show the world. And it's quite a deal. I mean, they have it all choreographed because they have some really great shots of the planes flying over and everything. So they're really excited to show the world a little bit of their teeth in that way. And if the U.S. is doing that, I haven't seen it. Do they do the same sort of thing?
Well, I think the tradition is that the U.S. Army doesn't do military parades unless it's for like a victory in a mm-hmm. war or something, or for veterans or that kind of thing, just because the fundamental principles of America aren't to glorify the army or put undue attention on it. So generally those kinds of things are not encouraged by the army to do in the same way that's glorified in other countries.
Right. So we probably have some nice stuff. We're just not showing it the same way.
Yeah, exactly. We don't show it off, and it's not, I think for America, we don't want the world to identify us as we have all these amazing missiles, and if you cross us, we're going to destroy you, like Iran and all these other countries do. America wants to be known for its democracy and ideals rather than its army. So I understand that, but the problem with that is that the U.S. Army can fall into obscurity from public view, and so when it's a serious issue like this, it doesn't really get a whole lot of support because people don't understand it that well. Because
right.
It's a lot of people. There's lots of service members and lots of families connected with the U.S. Army. But in general, I think the U.S. population, they have a little more obscure understanding of what the military does, its capabilities, and its history, I think, than what other countries do. And there are some good parts of that. I mean, you don't want the U.S. Army to become a Praetorian Guard that can decide who the next leader of the country is. And I think that's the main idea behind it. But you should also be proud of the achievements and want to keep it a proud force.
Yeah, I guess that's why I was kind of wondering about, say, parading it a little bit, because it's easy to not really know where we stand. You know, the assumption is, and it's been a right assumption for quite some time, that we do have, the U.S. has the most powerful military in the world. But I don't know. I mean, I personally don't know. We do see stories, and they come out, and the Trumpet.com highlights them a lot. We know where we're having problems with a new, you know, destroyer that was made, or something else is not working, or it's falling, you know, behind other nations. But if you're not really looking and paying attention to those types of stories, it's easy to just not know and assume, well, we just have overwhelming power, but it is changing somewhat.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, just that most people assume, well, America's military advantage will never be lost ever because we're just so powerful. But that's stories like this show that we're just at that threshold where other countries are not only catching up but surpassing us. And so with the M1A2 Abrams, first about 600 of them were made in 1990, and they debuted in the Operation Desert Storm in the Gulf War, and they literally shredded the any tanks the Iraqis could send at us. The Iraqis use old T-55s, T-60, T-70 Russian-made tanks. And the M1A2 Abrams, basically, the cannon was so powerful, it literally knocked the turrets off the other tanks, blasted holes in them. And just with U.S. air power as well, that's the first time where laser-guided weaponry was really used for the first time. on a large scale, and we just, in a matter of hours, Saddam Hussein's air power was destroyed, and then his tank force was defeated in less than 100 hours. And that was the main thing the world feared, or the Arab neighbors feared, was his tank force and his Scuds. And the tank force was destroyed. They were no match for the M1A2 Abrams.
Yeah, it's amazing. I remember watching that on television. It was strange. It was like watching a TV show. But they were no match for the U.S., and I think that really kind of set the world on its heels a little bit, like, wow. But at the same time, Iraq wasn't exactly, you know, the most fearsome nation in the world. Yeah. It was kind of like, well, I don't know. I was going to say it's kind of like, you know, the pro team playing the JV team, you know. Yeah, you look really good, but you also kind of play in the JV team. It wasn't a full-powered Russia or, you know, China, Russia, I guess, mainly, or, you know, other nation like that was really ready, massive population, that type of thing. So even though we looked pretty dominant there, we weren't going up against the world's best either.
Yeah, and that's the main point that's disturbing when you look at the history of the past 20, 30 years. Is that America? The last time America fought Russia, or, well, Russian-made technology, was the Korean War, like up-to-date Russian technology, when Russia gave China T-64 tanks and North Korea T-64 tanks, and the Shermans were no match. A big problem, what's interesting is America has always had a history of having weak armor. The Sherman tanks, they were faster than German tanks, but they were tin cans, and they had a lot of problems defeating German armor. Same thing in the Korean War. American anti-tank missiles like bazookas, they would bounce off T-64s. American troops would get mowed down because they had no, there was no way to penetrate the T-64's armor. And so in the Korean War, that caused a lot of problems. And so the danger of not learning from that history is that if we ever did fight the two Russian tanks now are the T-90, which the American military believes is about on parity with the M1A2 Abrams. The new tank the Russians are developing is the T-14 Armata, and this tank has a bigger gun than the Abrams. It also has something called an active protection system, an APS, and what that does is that if you shoot a missile or something at the tank, like a RPG, it will deploy countermeasures and detonate the explosive before it hits the tank. So it really makes it impervious if that APS works well. It really makes it hard for infantry to not go at tank. And so Russia's only beginning to deploy these T-14 Armatas, but if the U.S. Army ever had to fight against Russia, we have no idea if our anti-tank missiles would actually do anything against them. Because for years, we've just been fighting outdated, antiquated Russian tanks in Iraq, Iran, all these different Middle East countries who bought them from the Soviet Union. So that's the big question. No one knows if the M1A2 can actually stand up to it, because we won't know until we actually fight Russia in the major war. And at that point, it might be too late, because there are no plans for a next-generation tank for the U.S., and then at the same time, Germany is developing a new tank, the Leopard 3. The Leopard 2 is one they've had for decades. And it's just below the M1A2, but it's a very good tank. It's the one the Canadian Army used. My dad had some experience, and he said it's almost just as good as the M1A2 because he had some experience with the Leopard 2. The Leopard 3, though, is going to be next gen to be better than the M1A2. So America is falling behind against Russia and Europe. And so the M1A2 will work fine as long as we fight in countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, all these countries that don't really have their own capability. But if we ever did fight a major war against a major power, the U.S. might prove to be outmatched.
Yeah, that's interesting. And there's not really the backing, at least it seems like, in the U.S. to put a lot of money into that, nor is there the money. But people are pretty war-weary, I guess. But the reality is sometimes wars happen, whether you want them to or not, and you can't wait until it happens. I mean, I guess in World War II, a lot of things had to go right for us to come out on top there.
Right.
And because we were able to militarize pretty quickly because of Eisenhower in particular and others. But you know, you can't always do that, especially today when, you know, one major strike can be it because of the nuclear power.
Yeah, exactly. And this, something to understand as well is that this generation of American officers, American military doctrine teaches the American Army to plan a quick battle, a decisive battle in which you defeat most of the enemy army all at once in one fell swoop. This was done expertly in Desert Storm and then Operation Iraqi Freedom later under George Bush in 2001. The Iraqi army was wiped out in one big battle. And the reason the U.S. can plan that way is because they have superiority in heavy armor. So in tanks with big armor and then big guns that can destroy anything else. And then advantage in the air power too. If you don't have those two advantages, your army can't fight that fast, decisive battle. And then in Iraq, after that, the U.S. Had to fight terrorism, which you have to fight in a completely different manner. And the U.S. struggled for years to find a good strategy to do that. So if the U.S. Army, if they're fighting an enemy that's equal or better than them, the whole doctrine all these officers have been taught for decades will have to be thrown out the window. And America will have to improvise a new kind of strategy to fight their wars. And in Iraq, it took them about 6 years to do that. Fighting against Europe or Russia, I doubt they would have that much time before we were defeated. So that's the danger, is that what we saw America destroy Saddam Hussein's army twice in hours, that could very well happen to the U.S. Army if we lose a technological edge, and that's what we're doing.
It's interesting to see, interesting to look at, and you don't hear probably as much about that as we should in the media, but that's based upon an article and some research you did for a Trumpet article on the M1A2 Abrams tank. There's a lot of good info there at the trumpet.com about that. Make sure you listen for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show and for the Key of David program coming up here in a bit on KPCG. It's a brand new one this weekend, and talks about the mystery of civilization, human civilization, more advanced today than at any time in history. Yet man's problems are multiplying at an alarming rate. What is the cause of this paradox? Make sure you listen for that. If you don't have the Mystery of the Ages book, you can get that for free at thetrumpet.com. And it's a great book. You can have that sent to you, or if you can just read it there if you'd like to. There's a lot of ways to do that. It's a newtrumpet.com as well. It's been revised and updated. Some of the headlines today: Christian schools told to allow homosexual clubs or close. Related stories: nationalizing the family and redefining family. And also, of course, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show talks about the new Churchill movie. Make sure you listen for that. And Trumpet Hour Week in Review program. Is that enough? Plenty of stuff here on KPCG and at thetrumpet.com. I wanted to wrap up today with one note, an update on this story that is not that important, but people might find it interesting. Crayola said they were going to get rid of a crayon color. It's the first time they've done that in a long time, I guess. They have gotten rid of the color dandelion,
huh?
Which I'm not even familiar with. I guess it would be yellowish.
Yeah, light yellow, I guess, or something.
Yeah. Grant had thought it was going to be white, which I thought, well, maybe. I mean, because you usually color on white paper, so right. It's kind of a pointless crayon. But it is one of the bedrock colors as well. So sorry for the dandelion fans out there. It's over for you.
Yeah, I wonder if they'll replace it with a different kind of flower color. But yeah, I guess you need white because you might color on colored construction paper, and that's the only one that works on black and other colors. But yeah, dandelion had a good run, but I guess its time is up. So it'll be interesting to see if they launch a new color in its place.
Yeah, well, they probably will. I don't even know why it matters, but maybe maybe it's just gets them in the news more, and people rush out to buy the crayons. You kind of have to buy crayons if you're a kid.
Yeah,
your parents have to buy them. You don't. That's always like on the school supply list is crayons.
Yeah.
Were you a 12-pack kid, or were you one of the jumbo pack kids?
I think it was like a 6-pack.
you went down. We were talking about that the other day, and I can't remember. I was one of the smaller ones. I didn't have the big one with the sharpener.
Yeah.
And some people did, and I was a little envious of that.
It's funny. It's like your whole social status in elementary school is based on your crayons, and you don't mess with a kid who has 120 jumbo pack. Until it's time to clean up, and they spend half their lunchtime or recess just trying to gather all their crayons together.
Yeah, it's a lot of crayons. It's almost too many crayons.
Yeah.
There was always, we had one kid in particular that I don't know, probably they probably had a little more money than the rest of us, I guess. And the school supplies were always next level. You know, things that I hadn't seen, or we had, like, you'd have the general wood ruler, but they had like a fancy see-through plastic one, and it had other things on it, and you could, you know, you could do different things with it. And it was always fascinating. It, like you said, it really did determine sort of your social structure for at least for that period of class.
Yeah. It also gives you a lot of enemies.
I suppose that's another way to look at it. Another big thing back in our day was the trapper keeper. Which is probably, I think people still might use those, but that was really big. If you had a trapper keeper, you were set.
Yeah.
I did not have a trapper keeper.
for me and my generation, it was the markers. Yeah. If you had like the scented markers, you were popular. If you just had like the basic ones that dried out in a couple of days, you were the lower class, the peasants, I guess.
Yeah. Everything is all based upon odd things.
Yeah.
Possessions. And it depends on where you are in life, I guess, how you view those. But that's kind of an interesting thing. They got rid of the dandelion color. That's all the time we have for this weekend edition of Trumpet Radio Live. Hope you have a great weekend and enjoy yourself. Make sure you stay with us here at KPCG. Listen to the great programming. For myself, Dwight Falk, Abraham Blondo, we will talk to you again on Monday.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.